Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, America. It's your new favorite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two-fourths of the British podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely fact.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.
Hello, my name is Chrissy Champagne, and you are listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. In each episode of Residue, we break down the made-for-TV films and theatrical releases based on chilling real-life cases. Residue is created, hosted, written, researched, produced, and edited by me, Chrissy Champagne. And don't forget, you can find me on Instagram at Residue Podcast, TikTok at Residue A True Crime Pod, and Facebook at Residue A True Crime Podcast. And don't forget, the best thing that you can do for any podcast that you love is leave a 5-star review. Leaving a 5-star review for any podcast really helps push the podcast out to new audiences, and it makes me really happy. So, if you are enjoying the show, why don't you just take a little time to press that follow button so that you can remember to meet us back here every single Tuesday for a new episode. And if you are enjoying Residue, don't forget to hit that "Don't you remember you told me you love me, baby" button, follow button. Before we begin this week's episode, I want to give an extreme trigger warning for domestic violence. Now, this is the story of Francine Hughes, the movie The Burning Bed. And I want to let you know right ahead of this story, just a reminder, if you're ever feeling unsafe or overwhelmed, you can always reach out to the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233. They're there 24/7 and totally confidential. Please take note. There will be a lot of talk about violence, abuse, and this might be triggering for some people. Listener discretion is advised. The Burning Bed is a made-for-television drama directed by Robert Greenwald. It was first released in October 1984, and this movie is based on the real life of Francine Hughes, a woman who, after enduring years of domestic abuse, set fire to her husband's bed one night while he was sleeping. The film follows her descent from hopeful wife to desperate victim and the legal aftermath of the act. Francine Hughes' case was historically significant. She ultimately was found not guilty by reason of temporary insanity in one of the earliest cases to invoke battered wife syndrome as part of the defense. And this movie is credited with bringing public attention to domestic violence as a social issue. The film stars our made-for-television queen, Farrah Fawcett. Also, she played Diane Downs in Small Sacrifices, and many consider this her most serious role. Critics responded strongly to Farrah Fawcett's performance. The supporting cast was also highly praised. We had Paula Matt as Mickey Hughes, Richard Mazur, Penelope Milford, and James T. Callahan. In TV, the book, critic Matt Zoller Seitz ranked The Burning Bed as the 7th greatest American TV movie ever made, calling Farrah Fawcett's performance one of the greatest in history of TV movies. For 3 years prior to this film actually being made, nobody wanted to touch this movie. And then Farrah Fawcett got behind it, and she was instrumental in getting laws changed in California. And Farrah was so into this role that she even would put mashed potatoes in her hair and just run them through her hair before she filmed certain scenes because she wanted to make her hair look really dull. And she wanted women to hear what this movie was about. She didn't want it to be about how she was a glamorous TV star, movie star. The film was nominated for 3 awards at the 1985 Golden Globes. We had Best Actress in a TV Movie, Best Television Limited Series or TV Movie, and then Best Supporting Actor in a Limited Series or TV Movie for Paul LaMatt, who played Mickey Hughes, and he won that award. Critics noted that this film did not sensationalize the violence, but portrayed it in a way that emphasized the real-life horror many women experienced in abusive relationships. Francine Wilson was born August 17, 1947. Francine's very first childhood memory is being deprived of something that was rightfully hers. So Francine's first memory is driving in a truck with her family. She was about 5 years old, and it was close to Halloween. It was a chilly October starlit night. The family had gone into town that day. It was her father, her mother, her uncle, and her brothers and sisters. They go into town to buy the kids some winter coats because the cold days were ahead. Her mother also, as a surprise, bought the kids some peanut butter cups. And Francine remembers being snuggled in the back seat between her brother and her sister, her father and her uncle in the front seat, driving, passing a liquor bottle back and forth. But she didn't really think anything of it because they were just always fun when they were drinking. She didn't know that, you know, that's not good to be drinking and driving. She used to call the liquor, liquor candy. So they arrive home and they rush inside because it's a really snowy night. It is snowing so bad that their mom is just like, get inside, we'll get the jackets, we'll get the shopping bags and the candy later. And the very next morning when Francine awakes, she realizes that overnight, their vehicle, their family car, had burned, completely burned, because one of the men left a cigarette burning in the ashtray during the night, and the car lit up on fire. So the next morning, Francine and her brother go outside to kind of inspect the vehicle. They're not really supposed to be doing this. They get inside of that burnt up vehicle. It's like completely black, and the coats were just burned to shreds inside of that car. They didn't have winter coats now, but Francine is looking for the candy, thinking that the candy could have possibly survived this fire. She reaches her hand in between one of the car seat crevices, and she pulls out a perfectly preserved piece of peanut butter candy. And she realizes later in life when she's talking to a therapist that this is her very first memory. My main source for today's episode was The Burning Bed by Faith McNulty, and in it she writes that Francine was in prison when she was speaking with her therapist and realized this memory, and this is what Francine said of that memory. "I didn't think about it being anyone's fault. About Dad and my uncle being drunk. I didn't know about how hard Mom and Dad had worked to buy the coats or about what we'd do without them. I guess Mom got us clothes secondhand, but I remember how bad I felt about the candy." It did not seem to strike Francine that her first memory concerned being deprived of what was rightfully hers by a drunken man whom she trusted to love and protect her. Francine's father, Walter, married her mother, Hazel, when she was only 14. Walter was 25, Hazel was 14. Hazel had only been through about 3 years of grade school, and she couldn't read or write until her new husband, Walter, taught her. Francine's mother Hazel's childhood was, quote, grimly poor. And as a child, she worked for well-off families doing their housework. Walter and Hazel married and they moved to Lansing, Michigan. And their first years in Michigan were spent working on farms and living in houses on those farms that their employers provided for free. Hazel's first two babies died in infancy, and her first child to survive was Joanne, born in 1942. Robert Lee was born 2 years later, and then Francine was born in 1947. And now Francine was an unusual name for a baby back in 1947, but it's because her mother Hazel heard this French chanteuse on the radio and she vowed to name her next child Francine if she was a girl. Then, soon, David and Kathy were born. So Francine says her earliest years were her happiest, and she described herself as a child as having this really thick, pretty hair, and everywhere she went, everyone commented on how pretty she was, how smart she was, how nice she was. And she tried to live up to this and do just everything right. Francine also recalls that she never saw a fight between her mom and dad. They kept their fights to themselves. Now, Francine says she never really saw their fights, but they did hear little arguments while they were supposed to be in bed. They would hear their parents arguing about money, mainly. And she said that her dad did have a drinking problem, and he was drunk quite often. But that when he was drunk, he was never mean to the children. He always wanted to talk more, like he was in a happier mood. She says that she was never scared of her dad when he was drunk or sober, and that he'd be this jolly guy and tell the kids tall tales. But as Francine got older, as all of the kids grew up, her dad's drinking got out of control. It wasn't so jolly and funny anymore. And by this time, Francine had already left the home. But she heard stories from her younger sister that dad was beating mom. And Francine's mother, Hazel, was just too embarrassed to tell anyone about it. She just kept it to herself. Later on in life, Francine would realize, after being evaluated by psychiatrists, that there was one significant event in her childhood that sparked her to become overly sensitive to the suffering of others. And this was a horrible event involving her younger brother, David, who Francine described as a cute little kid. His hair was so blonde, and we called him Cotton Top. So he was about 3 years old, and Francine is hanging out in the yard with her mother. She's doing some laundry, hanging clothes up on the line. Her mother's telling her to keep an eye on little David. And a kid comes running up into the yard, a kid from the neighborhood, and says, "Hey, you guys, down at the gas station, there's a clown. He's giving out balloons. We should all go." So Francine brings her little brother, David, down to the gas station. They walk together. They get balloons. They're so happy. They bring the balloons back home. But then Francine goes back to her work, and she doesn't realize that David actually wanted to go back and see the clown. And he didn't tell anybody. He didn't ask anybody. And he just took off to the gas station on his own. And while doing this, little David was hit by a car. So everyone is gathered around David, an ambulance comes, and one of the children from the neighborhood goes running back to Francine's house and yells, "You guys, your little brother, your son, he was hit by a car down at the gas station." And Hazel just takes off running. She's hysterical. By the time she got there, the ambulance had already taken David away. And she just grabs Francine by the shoulders, yelling at her, "This is your fault. You're the one that was supposed to be taking care of him." This whole incident just aroused so much love, pity, and guilt inside of Francine. And David did recover, but Francine remembers needing to take care of him. She just wanted to do anything she could to help him. Which later we will see, these same feelings she felt when David was hurt are going to be the same feelings that she has when Mickey gets hurt. Like, she just wants to take care of people. Like, she feels like she has to. So how did Francine meet Mickey Hughes? Well, When she did meet Mickey Hughes, she described him as a very tall, very thin boy with thick black hair and dark blue-green eyes. So one night, Francine's parents go out on the town, and she's left at home to babysit her younger brothers and sisters. So she invites her friend Sharon over, and Sharon brings a bunch of people. One of those people was Mickey Hughes. Now, there was a bunch of girls, a bunch of boys, and everyone's running around the house acting crazy, like they're just so excited to be in a house without any adults, you know? And some of the girls were running into closets and playing the game like, if you can find me, you can kiss me. So they were playing like hide and go seek with kissing. And Mickey didn't join in. Mickey just stood there against the wall, smoking a cigarette and acting like he was too good. He's too cool for school, basically. Francine says that Mickey just struck her as mature, manly. And he said something to her like, you can go play that game if you want, but that game is for kids and I'm not a kid anymore. So he had that kind of attitude, and that was super attractive to her in that moment. She says that he was polite but disdainful at the same time. And as she was like giggling along with all of her friends, she immediately stops giggling and she takes Mickey's cigarette from him. And now she's into it. Mickey's like the John Bender of the crowd right now. From Breakfast Club. But Mickey wasn't so attractive to her the next day. So the next day she hangs out with him and she describes a situation where Mickey keeps trying to kiss her, to make out with her, and she doesn't want it. She wants nothing to do with it. And she's starting to find him less attractive because he's so persistent. And he just gets pissed off about it, that she won't kiss him. So she's like not finding this dude as attractive as she did the night before. So Francine starts to think that Mickey's a creep. He's forcing himself on her. She could care less. And then she sees him a third time. And this was at a dance. And at this dance, he walked up to Francine and he said, hey, do you think you'd want to go out with me sometime? And she said, sure, why not? But then later in life, Mickey would admit to her that the only reason he even asked her out that night was because his friend bet him a dollar that he wouldn't do it. Mickey Hughes lived with his parents in Dansville, and he dropped out of school at age 16. So an example of the kind of person that Mickey was and the way that his parents raised him, his parents promised him a car if he graduated high school, and he was like, well, I'm not going to graduate high school, and I want the car anyway, and they gave him the car. His mother, Flossie Hughes, was a tall woman with straight, handsome features and coal black eyes, and you could tell that Flossie was definitely the boss of that household. Her husband, Berlin Hughes, was a short man. He was silent, and he had a disagreeable face, according to Francine. Now, in the beginning of this relationship, Mickey pressured Francine to have sex a lot, and she always said no. She wanted to wait until she was married, and Mickey started telling her he loved her. He was like, come on, I love you. We're going to get married anyway. Let's just do it. She was like, no. And then it got to the point where he was basically love bombing her and telling her how much he loved her. And she felt obligated to say that she loved him back, even though she did not. She didn't feel love at all for him, but she felt bad if she didn't say it. So she is trying to get away from him in the beginning of this very young relationship. But Mickey was just so persistent. It was already like he owned her. She was his possession. And he does end up talking her into having sex before she is ready and before she wants to. And when they finish, he says to her, the first thing that boy says to her is, I mean, we don't have to get married now if you don't want to, but I still will. I mean, this love story, if you want to call it that, just gets so progressively worse. It's just fight after fight after fight, to the point where while I'm researching this, while I'm reading this book, I had to take so many pauses because he was just so horrible to Francine. I'm not going to reiterate every single time he beat the hell out of her, but I'm going to highlight a couple that I think are important. And the first one is important. Now, Francine and Mickey go on this double date with some other people to this party. And There was another girl there. So Francine and this other girl don't want to go into the party. They see some of Mickey's ex-girlfriends going into the party. They see some people they don't like. And they're like, we don't want to go. And the guys go in anyway. So Francine thinks it's going to be funny if she takes Mickey's car for a little joyride as a joke. And she goes speeding off and she can see Mickey and his brother, who was with them at the time, come running and chasing her. And she's just flooring the pedal and laughing. And then Mickey catches up to her and she stops the car. She gets out of the car. She's on the sidewalk. Mickey just rips her shirt open. He's grabbing her, yanking her. And then he puts both hands around her neck and starts to choke her as he's saying, don't you ever take my car again. And she said at that moment, she could see like the devil in his eyes. She'd never seen him that way until that point. But they do not break up. And right after that, November 4th, 1963, Mickey and Francine were married. Mickey was 18, Francine was 16. They get married, and she's scared to death at this wedding. Francine knew, standing up there, saying her vows to this man, that she was closing a chapter of her life and it was much too soon. She knew she should not be doing this. And what strikes me as so sad is that Francine says she looked into the crowd as she's up there saying her I do's to Mickey, and she sees her mother's face and it's just full of, no, please don't do this. And Francine said that she went to her mother to console her mother. Like, mom, it's going to be okay. She's reassuring her mother that this is the right decision. But Francine says, as she looks back, she was the one that needed reassurance. Like, she needed somebody to tell her, don't do this. Francine always imagined that marriage would bring her peace of mind, that she would have a huge home of her own for her to take care of, but instead she spent her days helping her mother-in-law, Flossie, do housework. And this house was so overcrowded, and Francine knew that they were a burden on her in-laws, and she desperately wanted to leave, but Mickey was content. I mean, Mickey had everything he wanted. His mom's taking care of him. His wife's taking care of him. He doesn't have any bills to pay. A few weeks after the wedding, Mickey lost his temper again in front of the entire family, and this started because of Francine's clothes. So Mickey didn't want her showing off her body. He didn't want her tucking her shirt into her ski pants because it could show off her body and he didn't want guys looking at her. So he rips her clothes off of her. And of course, they're in this tiny house with all of his brothers and sisters, with his parents, and everyone heard, but nobody said anything. Everybody just acted like it wasn't happening. Mickey is screaming at her, telling her he wants to tell her how to dress. She's going to dress the way he says she's going to dress. And of course, after the fight, the next morning, Mickey apologizes. And that's how it would continue going on for years. He would hurt her, he would embarrass her, and then he would say he's sorry. And now the next big fight happens because there are some men over at the Hughes house, and Mickey says that Francine was staring at one of these men. And Francine is like, I swear to God, I was not staring at this man like with lust. I was staring at him because he had the biggest hands I'd ever seen in my life. She thought that this was, you know, interesting, comical. She was just looking, but Mickey loses his shit. Again, Francine says, right in front of Flossie, right in front of Berlin, in front of his two brothers, he full on punches Maxine in the face, knocking her down to the floor and telling her, you will never look at another man again, you fucking whore. Also, let me add in that Mickey was consistently cheating on Francine this entire relationship. Now, during this fight, the whole entire house heard it again, but this time Mickey's father, Berlin, started screaming, stop it. And he went up there to stop Mickey from doing this to Francine, but that turned into a huge fight between Mickey and his father. So these two are going at it hard, and the police are called. The police arrive. Now, they're not allowed to do anything during a domestic violence situation. At this time, the police were only allowed to arrest someone if they actually saw them hurt the other person. But this would be the first of numerous times that a police officer is hit by Mickey. Now, one of the police officers puts his arm or his hand on Mickey's shoulder to tell him, come on, calm down. And Mickey strikes at him. So the police take Mickey away for that incident, not because he was abusing his wife or his father, because he tried to hit a police officer. So after this incident, this was the first time and the only time that Mickey's parents would stand up for Francine. And Francine is so scared after this incident that she calls her mom and she asks if she can come home for the night. And Mickey's father, Berlin, drives Francine home. And he tells her in the car on the way home, I am actually more proud to have you as a daughter-in-law than I am to have Mickey as a son. But as we will see, this does not last throughout the relationship. You will see that Flossie, Mickey's mother, she is such an enabler when it comes to Mickey. The police arrested Mickey that night, but he was set free real quick. And you know where he went after he was let go? To Francine's mother's house. So now Mickey has moved in to Francine's mother's house. And of course, when he's there, he's acting wonderfully polite. He's kissing Francine, hugging her, apologizing again. But that only lasted a couple of weeks because soon Mickey and Francine are driving down the street. She's just looking out the window. Some random guy walks by and Mickey yells at her again and says, why the hell are you looking at that guy? And then full on slaps her across the face while she's sitting in the passenger seat next to him in the car. It's just, she never knows when he's going to explode. For weeks before that, they were happy. She was cooking him breakfast every day. He was going to work. He was acting cheerful. And then randomly, out of nowhere, boom, another attack. Francine said in the book, The Burning Bed, sometimes things seemed to be working out as I hoped. Mickey would be nice and loving for weeks. I'd begin to feel secure and then wham, he'd get me over some tiny thing and let me have it. I'd have a black eye and my feelings would be all torn up again. Another fight erupted when Francine and Mickey's friends, Sharon and Bill, were over to their apartment. Now, Sharon and Bill were going to be driving to Jacksonville, and this is a chance that Francine could have to go see her mother because that's where her mother lived. So she wanted to get in the car with them and go see her mom. And Mickey said, no, there's no reason for you to go there. I'm not going to allow you to go there. And Francine yelled back, yes, I am going to go there. And Mickey just punched her square in the face in front of both friends, knocking her to the floor. As Sharon and Bill just dart out of the apartment, they leave. They leave Francine there. Mickey calls into work that day, stays home, and beats the hell out of Francine day and night that day. Francine soon takes off to her mother's house in Jackson. And I'm sorry, I believe I said Jacksonville earlier. I meant Jackson. She takes off. She goes there. She stays at her mother's house. And she says that her parents didn't really want her there. Now, she finds out that she is pregnant while she is staying at her mother's home. And of course, her mother says that, you know, Francine, you shouldn't be hasty in ending your marriage when you have a baby on the way. She said they didn't talk about what was happening. Nobody comforted her. Nobody told her to get away from this situation. They were forcing her to go back. And in this whole time, Mickey is just persistent again, as he's been since the beginning. He's begging her to come back. He flies to Jackson. He's like, come home. I love you. I'm sorry. I'm a changed man. Now he has his mother calling Francine. And Flossie's like, come on, he's changed. You got to come home. And so finally, because nobody's just supporting her, nobody's telling her not to do this, Francine says, okay, let's give it another shot. Mickey comes to pick her up. They drive home. No, wait, they don't drive home because Mickey forgot to tell Francine, oh yeah, we don't have the apartment anymore. I don't have a job. We're going to go to my parents' house and live there again. So they drive straight to Flossie and Berlin's house. And now Francine is back where she started. Francine is 7 months pregnant. And Mickey says, guess what? I don't want to do this. I don't want a wife. I don't want a child. And Francine says, what am I supposed to do?
I'm about to have a baby. And he goes, I don't care. Go live with your mom. I don't want it anymore. He packs up all of his stuff and he leaves her. She calls her friends Bill and Sharon to help her. She's got to move out of this apartment, go back to her mom's. And as they're leaving to take Francine to her parents' house, they drive past Mickey's house and they see him coming out of his parents' house with a girl. And on top of all of this, Francine gets to her parents' house and her mother is not comforting. As usual, she's immediately like, what are you going to do? How are you going to pay the doctor bills? Who's going to pay for the child? What are you going to do? And Francine is just losing her mind. Francine is 17 years old. Just think about that in this moment. This girl has no safe place to fall. So she calls Mickey and she says, listen, we have a child coming. We have to get back together. And Mickey tells her he doesn't want anything to do with this baby. He doesn't want anything to do with the bills, with paying child support. And he tells her, listen, if you're going to try to get me to pay child support, you're going to have to make me pay child support. This is your baby. You do whatever you need to do, but I don't want to be a part of this. Now, years later, Francine would realize after this is all over that this is the moment she could have gone on her own. She could have gotten help from welfare. She could have survived without Mickey, but she didn't know that. She was 17. Nobody was telling her anything other than, well, what are you going to do? You better get back with Mickey because he's a man and you need the man to help take care of the child. And on top of that thought process, Francine admits that she loved Mickey. She thought she loved Mickey. She knew she depended on Mickey. This is all she's ever known. She was pregnant with his child and her love for Mickey grew out of being with him for so long. And this is all she knew. And as many people in relationships that are abusive do, the minute she wasn't with him, all she could remember were the good times. And she missed him and she loved him and she wanted him to come back because her brain was focused on all of the good times that they had. And the same cycle again. Mickey's mother, Flossie, says you should be with your baby and your wife, and Mickey says okay, and then he and Francine get back together, and then they lose their apartment, and they go and they live with the Hughes again. They have their first daughter, Christy, and for a while after Christy was born, things were okay. But Francine starts to accept the fact that she's going to have to tiptoe around Mickey. There were instances where Mickey would just be irate for no reason. Francine would be sitting there feeding her child, rocking her in a rocking chair, and Mickey would walk right up to her and throw milk in her face and start screaming at her. And Francine wouldn't fight back. She would just stand up, put the baby down, and clean the milk up. She knew the only way she could keep Mickey happy at this point is to just stop fighting back, to just take it and move on. So through friends, Francine starts to find out that Mickey is cheating on her again, just running with women all over town. They get into an argument about it, and she takes a coffee mug, throws it at him in the middle of an argument, and it hits him in the back of the neck and cuts him open. He runs to his mother's house. She helps him get this cut taken care of, and she is pissed at Francine. She is so mad at Francine. She goes to her house, starts screaming at her about, don't you ever hurt my son. You could have really hurt him. And Francine says back to Flossie, well, what do you think could happen to me when he's always hitting me? You don't care about that. You don't care about what he's doing to me. At this point, it is October 1965. Their first child, Christy, is only 7 months old. And Francine finds out that she is pregnant again. Mickey and Francine would go on to have 4 children together. Now, in the movie The Burning Bed, there are only the first 3 children that are portrayed in that film. They had Christy, they would have James, Jimmy, Berlin Jr., Nicole, and Dana. So, by the time Francine is pregnant with her 4th child, Mickey's out of work, and she's desperate. She has no money to feed the kids. She has no money coming in, and she goes to the welfare office and she's asking them for help. She's like, listen, I need to feed my children. Now, here's the thing. At this time, you could not apply for benefits or for help from the state for welfare unless you were the head of the household. And Mickey was head of household and he wasn't going to do it. So Francine is sitting there begging these people to help her. Like, look at me. I can't even buy soap to clean my children. That's how poor I am. Finally, they tell her, listen, if you get a divorce, you can have, we can help you. We can give you food stamps. We can help you with rent. We can help you find housing. But you're going to have to get a divorce. April 1971, Francine and Mickey are officially divorced. She is still pregnant with her fourth child, and her and the three children move out and get their own apartment. And before anybody says it or thinks it, Francine tried so hard to get birth control. There was an instant where she did obtain birth control and it failed. And this other time she tried, her doctor didn't believe in it. And so she wasn't able to be prescribed birth control. And, you know, there's no getting around the fact that Mickey was forcing himself upon Francine. And sometimes she would just have sex with him because she knew that it would, you know, maybe stop a fight, maybe stop an argument if she just gave in. So Francine is about to deliver her fourth child. Mickey comes to the hospital after she's already moved out, found this great apartment for her and the kids, and he is again begging her to let him back into her life. She doesn't want to. She's doing this on her own now. But that night, Mickey leaves the hospital, and he is in a horrific car accident. And again, referring back to the time that she felt like she was responsible for her little brother David's accident in the beginning of her life, she feels this same way about Mickey right now. And she tells a jury during her trial that she didn't want to hurt him more than he already had been hurt. And Francine lets Mickey move into their new apartment. And again, the same cycle. Mickey is nice for a little bit. Francine is taking care of him. And then boom, Mickey is nonstop abusing Francine. He's doing this right in front of the children. He is getting more violent as the days go on. They're not even married anymore. They're divorced. Francine wants him to leave the apartment. He will not leave. Oh, it angers me so much. He's, you know, telling her she's worthless. She's dumb. Now she decides she's going to have to do something. She's going to have to get an education. She's going to have to start making money. So she finds out about this grant, and she knows Mickey's not going to let her go to college, go to school at all. But she thought, you know, maybe if I tell him that if I am going to classes, we're going to get some money from the government and that'll ease his mind. It doesn't. Now that Francine is showing a more independence, she's showing that she could be an educated woman that takes care of herself. He's getting so much more violent towards her. Francine enrolls in secretarial school, and she is loving these classes. She loves learning, but she's having a difficult time taking care of the kids, taking care of her classes, being the only person to take care of the household, and Mickey is like her fourth, fifth child at this point. On March 9th, 1977, so Francine has a full day of school. She comes home. She's so tired. She just wants to feed her children, get her children ready for bed. She wants to do her schoolwork, and she wants to get some sleep. And now, do you think that Mickey's taking care of the kids all day while she's off at secretarial school? No, hell no. Half the time, Mickey's telling the kids to get out of the house, stay outside. These kids haven't been fed all day. They are begging their mother for food. So she gets them in the car. She's like, okay, let's go to the store and let's buy something for dinner. And she's tired. She's been working her ass off. She's basically a single mother, just has this bum living in her home. So she tells the kids, you know what, pick out anything you want. And the kids pick out TV dinners, which is perfect. They're so quick and easy to make. She's like, cool, let's go home. They get home, and Mickey is just insanely upset about the fact that she bought these kids TV dinners. She is a woman. She should be making a homemade dinner for her children. Even though this dude's been laying around doing jack shit the whole day, he tells her, there's no fucking way my kids are eating this shit. You get in that kitchen and you make them something good to eat. I mean, this is it. This is her boiling point. She has had it. She has gone through the steps. She has gotten this man out of her life, and this man is now back in her house, and she knows she can't go back to this again. This is it. And if you have watched The Burning Bed, this is the most horrifying scene in that movie. I tried to rewatch it as part of my research for this episode, and there are just so many parts where the character of Mickey is hurting Francine in front of those children. I just started crying, like bawling my eyes out. I couldn't watch it. I couldn't believe how, I'm gonna cry thinking about it, how perfect Farrah Fawcett was in this role. You didn't look at her and think she was Farrah Fawcett in these scenes. You saw her as Francine. You saw her as every single woman who has had to go through this in front of her babies. So on this night when the fighting first starts and Mickey is berating Francine that she bought the wrong dinner, he's slapping her around, the fight starts to erupt. Francine yells to Christy, "Call the police," and Christy calls the police and the police show up and the police see that this woman is clearly beaten. She's been beaten up. Her kids are crying. Her kids are dirty. Everyone looks like they haven't had the greatest night, but the police can't do anything because, as I said, at this time, they have to see the person actually hit the other person in order for them to make an arrest. And the police leave. And after they leave, this is when things get worse than anyone could ever imagine. Francine and the kids are just in the kitchen, sitting at the table. Nobody knows what to do. Everybody's crying. They're being quiet. They don't want to make Mickey mad. And Mickey just comes up and just full on punches Francine in the face, knocks her to the floor. He starts beating her. He takes all of the food she just made. He throws it to the floor. He makes her clean it up. He's telling her she's not going to school anymore. She's so stupid. He puts all of the food into the garbage can, or he makes her put all of the food into the garbage can after cleaning it up. He takes the garbage can. He dumps it all over the floor again, and he is forcing her face down to the floor and forcing her to eat the food off of the floor and just telling her how much he hates her and how stupid she is. Then he tells her she's going to burn all of her college books. He makes her go outside, take every single thing she has from her classes, put it into this bin and just burn it, burn everything, because she's never going back to that school. Mickey tells Francine it's only going to get worse. He is ready to make things 1,000 times worse for her, more than she could ever imagine. And then he tells her, "Make me some dinner." She has to do that. And then he demands that she has sex with him. And he's wasted beyond belief. And this is when Mickey just passes out in the bed and Francine goes out to the children. She gets everyone dressed. She tells them they're going to leave. She puts all of the children in the car. She packs up some of their clothes, gets their jackets on, gets them settled in the vehicle. She goes back into the room that Mickey is passed out drunk in. She takes gasoline and she pours it around the entire bed. And then she lights a match. She walks out to the car, calmly sits in the car with her children and watches that house burn before she drives away to the police station to turn herself in. And now Francine Hughes said, in that moment, she knew she could never return. If she put the kids in the car and she just drove away without setting that house on fire, she's going to come back. And this is going to happen again and again. And what's the only way that she can make sure this doesn't happen again? She's going to burn it all down and she has nothing to go back to. Now, Dana, Francine's child, he was about 8 years old. He was at a friend's house that night, so he didn't witness any of this. And Francine waited a little bit to see if Dana was going to come home. She didn't want him to come home to this fire. But Dana never came home, so she drove to the police station. And once she got there and told them what she did, she told them she needed them to make sure that her son, Dana, did not go near that house because she thought he's going to come home and he's going to be scared and he's going to try to run in there. So police are just, I mean, this woman just drove up to the police station in hysterics and said, I killed my husband. I burned the house down. And they were just like, what do you mean? And she's like, I burned him. He's in the bed. And they couldn't believe what they were hearing. Police, the fire department, they all arrive at the home. And when it's safe to go in, they enter that bedroom that Mickey passed out in and they find his body. And his cause of death was asphyxiation. Now, I want to give you a little scene that I read in the book. So one of the firefighters who goes in tries to grab Mickey from the bed. They grab at his ankles, and when they did and they tried to pull, just skin came off, and the firefighter fell backwards. Of course, Francine was charged and arrested right away with first-degree murder. A former prosecuting attorney named Arjun Graydenis was appointed to represent Francine in this first-degree murder trial. And he decided, instead of going for self-defense, he was going to go for innocent by reason of temporary insanity. Years later, in 2017, Arjun spoke to WKAR. He said that 40 years ago, there really was no comprehensive approach to domestic abuse. There was a lot of domestic abuse going on, and police were going in and were not really treating these situations very well. Society at that time was very male-oriented and simply would not give an ear to what women were saying. Now, Arjun, he praised the book, The Burning Bed by Fake McNulty. He said that this book was completely accurate. It told the story accurately. The movie, he said, is not very accurate in his estimation. And he says it's a very dramatic movie and it does a very good job of presenting the cruelty and the horror of this kind of situation. But factually, as movies will do, it is not very accurate. Women had been taught to keep the secret of abuse, but now they were getting loud. And as earlier in her life, Francine, she had no sympathy for her situation. Nobody cared. Police didn't help her. Her family didn't help her. Now there was this women's movement, and her case, her situation had gained traction. It gave rise to a movement. Women had been waiting for the chance to say something because traditionally wife beating, it was considered a family affair. Keep it in the marriage, keep it in the household. But when Francine's case took over, the media was all over it. Francine Hughes's case coined the term battered wife syndrome. This is a pattern of signs and symptoms displayed by a woman who has suffered persistent intimate partner violence, psychological, physical, or sexual, from her partner. And although the diagnosis has mainly centered on women, it has occasionally been applied to men when employing the term battered person syndrome. So Francine's lawyer thinks that if they say that she was temporarily insane because of all the abuse, this might make a jury more sympathetic to her. And it worked. And Francine got up on that stand and she testified in her own defense. And she told that jury that she heard voices and they kept saying, do it, do it, do it. And the jury found this believable. And now the prosecution was trying to say that Francine, she was a bad woman. She was having an affair at college, when in reality, what really happened was that when she went to these classes, she did meet a man, but she only spoke to him for like a couple of days. But this man was telling her so many nice things about her. Like, he was like, you're so pretty, you're so smart. He was giving her confidence. And when Francine told this story to the jury, it made her even more sympathetic because they felt like, you know what? This woman has been beat down for so long that just having a random man give her a few compliments, it made her feel like a human again. It made her feel like she wasn't this person that could be pushed around. The jury was so sympathetic to Francine's situation, they found her not guilty. Francine Hughes was acquitted, and this was an unexpected victory for her and for the feminist movement. Now, there is a short documentary called The Burning Bed, and this is from Retro Report. They interview Francine's son, James Hughes. I do have this short documentary linked in the show notes, and there's also a New Yorker article that I found a lot of information on. And now James says in this doc that she did try to get away, and he distinctly remembers his father saying, "There is nowhere you can go, bitch, that I won't find you." And I think it's important to note this. Now, in this documentary, they also, along with following the story of Francine Hughes, they do follow the story of Tamaya Hunter. Now, she was a Black woman that was charged with the murder of her boyfriend. And Black women are abused and incarcerated at higher rates than white women. And those who fight back against their abusers face an uphill battle in courts. So Tamaya pleaded self-defense because she stabbed her boyfriend while he was choking her. But she was found guilty, and she was sentenced to 15 years to life in prison. So her history of abuse hardly was addressed at this trial. Now, I wanted to talk about this also because in this short film, the prosecutors in these two cases, they're both white men. They say that abuse is horrible, but women have options. And by claiming this, you are saying that is just leave. There's you know, people in abusive relationships, but you can just leave. Not understanding that the truth is that you cannot just leave. It is so much more complicated than that. And that leads me to Tamaya Hunter's lawyer, Tiffany Smith. She represents women who are incarcerated, survivors of domestic violence, and I love what she said. A woman doesn't go on a first date, get punched in the face, and stay with this person. What happens is very calculating. It is very slow. Women leaving an abusive partner are more likely to be killed immediately upon leaving than any other time. Now, I do want to let you know that Tamaya was actually granted clemency and released after serving 15 years. Francine Hughes' case influenced the idea that law enforcement and judicial systems need to take abuse claims more seriously. They can't dismiss them because abuse happens behind closed doors. This case helped energize and expand the battered women's shelter movement and other support services because people realized that victims needed safe shelters, they needed counseling, and they needed legal help. After Francine Hughes' trial and acquittal, the term domestic violence became more widely used and more people began speaking out publicly about abuse. More women started leaving abusive relationships. Francine Hughes did end up becoming a nurse. She was an LPN and worked at several nursing homes. And after she retired, she would sit with the elderly and she even taught nursing classes. Immediately after being released from jail and acquitted, Francine got a job as a secretary, but she found it very hard to move on. She started drinking heavily. She was going through some rough times at first. And she met this man named Robert Wilson. They were married in 1980, but her children didn't like Robert. And she found it difficult to maintain a close relationship with her children because of Robert. Francine Hughes died on March 22, 2017, from complications of pneumonia. She was 69 years old. Francine Hughes set a legal precedent with her case. And in her words, that night, when she set that bedroom on fire, Francine said, "I felt like I was never coming back. Never. And that's when I decided to burn everything because there wouldn't be anything to come back to. Burn it all." Stay safe and stay paranoid. Stay paranoid.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take 5 before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Let's chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello, America. It's your new favorite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, 2/4 of the British podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.